Richard Blanco is the fifth presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history, the youngest first Latino, immigrant, and gay person to serve in such a role. Born in Madrid to Cuban exile parents and raised in Miami, the negotiation of cultural identity and place characterize his body of work. His new book of poetry, How to Love a Country, sits straight in this intersection. We'll talk about the need to explore the challenges and beauty of country, as well as get into his work in the Rogue Valley this summer with the SOU Young Artists Institute. Poet Richard Blanco today on The Keenest Observers. Richard Blanco is the author of the poetry collections Looking for the Gulf Motel, Directions to the Beach of the Dead, and City of 100 Fires, the poetry chapbooks Matters of the Sea, One Today, and Boston Strong, a children's book of his inaugural poem, One Today. Illustrated by Dav Pilkey, and Boundaries, a collaboration with photographer Jacob Hesler. His latest book of poems, How to Love a Country, both interrogates the American narrative, past and present, and celebrates the still unkept promise of its ideals. He has also authored the memoirs The Prince of Los Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood, and For All of Us, One Today, An Inaugural Poet's Journey. Blanco has continued to write occasional poems for organizations and events such as the reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Richard Blanco, thanks, and welcome to The Keenest Observers.
Great, thanks.
You are welcome. I wanted to take a moment because most folks may have an understanding of who you are from being the presidential inaugural poet for Barack Obama and your poem that you recited there, One Today. But this new book really celebrates, I believe, your love of country and twists the idea of what it is to be kind of a patriot. And I use that term in quotes because it has some weight to it. But I want to read this really quickly from your book. It's from the end of Declaration of Interdependence, and it goes, "We hold these truths to be self-evident. We're the cure for hatred caused by despair. We're the good morning of a bus driver who remembers our name, the tattooed man who gives up his seat on the subway. We're every door held open with a smile when we look into each other's eyes the way we behold the moon. We're the moon. We're the promise of one people, one breath declaring to one another, I see you, I need you, I am you." Seems to me that this is like your work's premise across the board. You are a patriot. Would that be accurate to say?
Yes, definitely. And I just first want to congratulate. That was a wonderful reading of the poem. It's usually a little bit odd when people read your poems. That was excellent. I couldn't have read it better myself. Yes, and I think it's the very first poem that opens up the book, and it sort of sets the tone for the book, sort of the manifesto for the book, so to speak. And it's this idea of, still trying to fulfill our motto of out of the many one, e pluribus unum. And I think part of, how I've been sort of repatriized, so to speak, was the experience of serving as inaugural poet for Obama, realizing that America is still very much a work in progress, right? It's still a great social experiment. And I wanted to explore that through poetry, both through a very personal lens, but also through a very oracular voice, a voice of we the people, and also interrogate. I mean, to look at our history and see where we failed and see how we can learn from that. That particular poem was inspired by a few things. One was the Declaration of Independence. But I think what I'm arguing for here, and I think where I think our country may need to move towards, is interdependence, understanding that idea, which is somewhat of a Buddhist idea as well, the idea that we all need each other to really thrive and survive, and that is the future of our society versus, every independence is much better than dependence, but also independence implies that it's, every person for themselves, right? I'm independent from everyone else. So that poem tries to speak to that, and it borrowed a saying from, or a greeting from the Zulu people. When they say good morning, they look you straight in the eyes and say, I see you. And I think there's something very powerful in looking and seeing each other both literally and figuratively. And I think you know, I think the book is arguing that we need to see each other a little bit better, that we've forgotten how to see each other, how to look into each other's eyes with compassion and empathy and understanding. That's really, you know, and you know, it's just getting back to the idea of being a patriot. Being an immigrant, and by 45 days, but also raised in an immigrant household, you know, you're taught that these ideals, I mean, my mother left Cuba 7 months pregnant, left her entire family behind for the sake of those ideals. And so you grow up with a hyper sense of that promise that we have, that this country has made the world, right, of this promise of democracy and a just and equitable society. So I very much come back to those things as a way of perhaps binding us together rather than splitting hairs sometimes with issues, but rather let's get back to what the mission and vision of this country was or is.
Yeah, I totally want to get into that as we continue. In this first segment, we've got about another minute, but you've transitioned very beautifully into the next portion of our conversation. But I wanted to say also the Declaration of Interdependence is consciously put as the first poem that we see in the book, even before the first section. Are you giving us as readers the downbeat of what you want us to kind of have in our heads?
Yes, that's exactly right. In writing a book of poetry, there's something we call a furnace poem or a gateway poem, and that first poem is very important because it announces the concerns, the themes, the movement that you can expect in the book. And by the same token, the last poem in the book as well sort of bookends that that idea of coming together. So yes, that's definitely very purposeful, and the fact that it is a declaration as well, right? Thinking about how this is, I'm also declaring what the book is, what journey you're going to expect on the book. So it's a very important place in a book of poetry, and it's interesting because a lot of people don't realize how much pain poets sometimes go through in terms of trying to organize the poem so that you there is an arc, there is a sense of movement, there is a story. From first poem to last poem.
Right on. We're going to talk more about your journey. Richard Blanco is my guest. Stay with us. With past presidential inaugural poet Richard Blanco, who will be spending time in the Rogue Valley this summer with the SOU Young Artist Institute, and his new book of poetry, How to Love a Country, explores the challenges and opportunities of America. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the journey of not only Richard Blanco, but of the poet to get pen to paper and words on the page, which folks generally kind of don't know. Can you continue telling us about how that is and was for you? I mean, I think that's an interesting kind of synthesis point, actually, like, because, you know, your road as an immigrant purely informs your road in your work. How did that come about, or is it something that just was a natural part of your development?
It's natural, and yet showing up is a big part of it, right? Just being, trying to be aware and trying to think about one's own journey and how that's reflected in the poetry that you're trying to put on the page. What do you come to the page with, right? It's writing is an exploration of one's life and journey as well. And I think as I look back through the entire body of work and thinking about how this book came to be, this latest book of poetry, How to Love a Country, I think every poet, in some ways, as they say, is writing one poem all their life. And the idea being that there's some kind of unique obsession that takes hold of them, usually at a very early age. And in a way, their entire body of work is an attempt to answer that question or ask some new questions related to that obsession or just explore that question. And for me, that obsession comes down to one word, and that's home. Mm. And what does that mean, right? Mm. And country, of course, is a big part of that, if not the majority of that. How do we identify as home? What do we call home, and what makes us feel at home? And I think it was a question that was with me since I was practically before I was even born. My mother left Cuba 7 months pregnant, so I was already, I was a stowaway already. I was born in Madrid, and 45 days after my birth, we immigrated to the United States. So by the time I was 45 days old, I belonged to three countries already, figuratively, and had lived in two world-class cities. So this is the obsession that caught hold of me, I think, when I was obviously at a very, very young age, thinking about what is my place, what is home, my culture, identity, and country became a big part of that. And so throughout my books, there have been an exploration in one context or another of what that means. What does it mean to be a Cuban-American? What does it mean to be a gay Cuban-American in this country? And, you know, serving as inaugural poet deepened that same question, right, or added more dimension to that question of home. Because to be honest with you, Rob, you know, part of the hardest part about writing the inaugural poem wasn't the writing of the poem itself, but actually asking point blank, asking myself, do I love this country, right? Does this country love me back? Am I really part of this narrative or not, right? How can I write a poem for America if I don't feel connected to it? And so in a way, the inaugural poem is an answer to that. It's saying, no, I am part of this country. This is part of our narrative. And that's been the journey until that point. And this book is a further exploration of thinking about those connections to the country, again, not just autobiographically, but for many people like myself who have probably questioned if they are part of this American story, if they are truly are part of We the People, and what does that mean? So it's a very scary book for me because I usually write from a much more autobiographical lens, and so this book dares to speak more about the we, to speak about issues of race and gender and sexuality and all the rest that aren't necessarily completely autobiographical experiences, but of course, they are in another way. They are because I live in this country and we're experiencing these things. We have to talk about these things. But it was a further extension of that obsession of home, except I'm not just asking it for myself. I'm sort of asking it for all of us. And the book itself, you know, How to Love a Country, is both a statement and a question, right? Mm. How does one love a country, and what does that mean, and what are the connections that make us, like we started the conversation, what is patriotism really, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're talking to presidential inaugural poet Richard Blanco. He will be in the Rogue Valley with students in the SOU Young Artist Institute, and has a new book of poetry, How to Love a Country. I want to ask you a question about that, though. You covered a lot of ground in that answer, but I'm curious about what prompted you to do exactly, you know, what you just said. What prompted the need to write, you know, along those lines?
In this particular book, I think you know, in general, I always say thinking makes me write, and writing makes me think. Mm. So it's a way of processing questions, emotions, dilemmas, memories. So writing is where I come to as a way to understand myself and this place in this world and the world around me. As I always like to say, my poems are way smarter than I am. and that's because they explore things that we don't always, you know, when we think about something in our lives, the first expected response is usually not the truest one, right? It's until we pause and reflect and think. And writing does that for me. And I think, you know, artists in general do that, and I think that's why people are attracted to the arts, because the artists have taken the time to press the pause button and say, what are we really talking about here? What are we really thinking about here? And so in this book in particular was urged on by that question of where are we as a country, and where has the shift occurred, and what are we working through, right? And trying to get to know my own country in a way that I maybe had never questioned before. Again, I'm 51, so I grew up in the days where the textbooks, you know, had a PG or a G-rated version of what really happens, what our history is really about. So it was a further deepening of trying to understand this country that and its ideals, and also its history and its not such great history, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what urged me to come to the page and think about that in all those various contexts that I wouldn't have ordinarily explored. It's the writing that makes me do that.
I also love how the work is general country to specific Richard, and you have on your website an interesting comment. You say sometimes dealing with identity and development, that you talk about being the Cuban Blanco or the American Richard. What does that mean, and how does that inform what you're talking about as well?
Well, yeah, that's a great observation. I mean, I did want the book to not just be like sort of a one beat kind of poem, you know, the same poem 40 times. I wanted it to have a rhythm between some very much more still autobiographical or very intimate and personal experiences of what it means to, what experiences of my connection to this country, and my own questioning, as well as thinking about the larger lens of, well, who are we? And so I wanted the book to do that, you know, kind of rhythmically. Change the aperture, the lens, the opening. Well, I think, you know, it's sort of an embarrassment of riches. I just have so many sort of possible identities and so many, I think, dimensions of how I see and think about the world. And so the idea of being the American Richard, the Cuban Blanco, I mean, I just love, like, my name is completely translatable, right? So I often joke, you know, my real name is Ricardo de Jesus Blanco, or you can call me Dick Jesus White, you know? So that this idea of malleability or being able to permeate different spaces, because of the experience, my experiences culturally. I'm also a civil engineer, so I know that a whole other world too of how to think and see the world. I also know two languages, which is another, you know, knowing another language is knowing another way how to be and think and breathe in the world. So, I feel I move between all these spaces. Always, I think back with the idea of searching, well, what is home in this landscape of so many possibilities to connect with, and what are the pluses and minuses of all those identities, and are they separate? Right. Mm-hmm. For years, I thought I still had to pick between being Cuban or American. You know, that I had to be loyal to one cultural heritage, and it wasn't until, I think you mentioned in the introduction. Wasn't until I read the poem at the reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba that I realized, oh my God, I don't have to pick. Mm-hmm. You know, I can be all these things and move between them. And that itself is identity, that permeability, that ability to morph, that sort of shift, to be a shift changer, right, is part of what I'm thinking about now.
I totally want to get into that because I often, when I talk to people and folks of color in specific, sometimes there is a breeding with us to be multidimensional for survival. So, and I know what that is personally, but I also want to get into the fact that you are an engineer by training and worked as an engineer as well as an artist. But I also want to read this as well from your book, Como Tú, Like You, Like Me. And a portion of that. Como tú, I question history's blur in my eyes each time I face a mirror. Like a mirror, I gaze into my palm, a wrinkled map I still can't read, my lifeline, an unnamed road I can't find, can't trace back to the fork in my parents' trek that cradled me here. Como tú, I woke up to this dream of a country I didn't choose, that didn't choose me, trapped in the nightmare of its hateful glares. Como tú, I'm also from the lakes and farms, waterfalls and prairies of another country I can't fully claim either. Como tú, I am either a mirage living among these faces and streets that raised me here, or I'm nothing, a memory forgotten by all I was taken from and can't return to again. Same kind of sentiment that this, you know, melange of like identity connects us all, but, you know, just like the challenge of that melange, we have opportunity. And I wish I could have, I could read the rest of the poem because it does circle back. But it speaks exactly what you were talking about, which is like this idea until you realize that you are all and connected to all, that there is some challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Once again, thank you for that beautiful reading. Are you sure you're a poet at night there? You're reading at the cafes?
I can't tell you about my past history in such short times.
But, you know, that poem was dedicated to the DACA dreamers, right? And I was thinking about their struggle and their position in history, right, caught in the crossfire of all these things. And I was thinking, but again, when I got here at 45 days old, which wasn't my choice, I had no choice in that, right? And sort of my parents brought me here, and thinking about, you know, how that connects, you know, I love Cuba, and I've been to Cuba several times, and it's a cultural home, one of my cultural homes, but I can't imagine sort of being told that I have to, or being deported and saying, this is your home now, and you live there, and that's it, and you only have that, you only have that identity, right? So it was kind of a poem of camaraderie, of empathy, of solidarity with the DACA dreamers, and thinking about that their position again in this melange, as you're saying. And you're making me think that also, I think what that poem is thinking about, and I think this is a challenge that we're facing more so globally, is this idea that in a way we are all interconnected, and the movements of people are how we're connected through economies, through modes of transportation, through technology. There is kind of this narrative that's being written underneath what are sometimes reactions to that, which we're also seeing right now in our country. We're also seeing it like in Brexit, this idea of, oh no, we have to control the narrative. We can't be everybody. We can't be everything because, you know, in all honesty, that is human nature. You know, we are scared to live in that space where we're sort of untethered or anchored, or we're everything and nothing at the same time. But that's what's happening in the world. So I think it's kind of the 21st century question is, how do you hold on? How do you celebrate your own diversity, your own uniqueness, and others' diversity and uniqueness, while also recognizing that at the end of the day, our ideal is to all become one, right? And how do you manage all that, right? It's a world in a way more complicated than I grew up in terms of even immigration, in terms of what we're seeing, in terms of not just immigration, but migration, environmental refugees. You know, the world is really, really completely interconnected in some ways, and it's a struggle because we're not sure, you know, we're still in some ways still hardwired to have that tribal mentality, right? And so I think that's been my journey, is learning how to let go of some of that, and yet again, not letting go of it, but bringing it all into the fold, right? Mm-hmm. And saying it's okay. Like Basho, one of my favorite quotes by the Japanese poet Basho, is, you know, that life is a journey, and the journey itself is home, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea that whoever we are, however we are, that is our home, that is our grounding, that is our identity, right? And the world doesn't always see it that way. You know, everybody, you know, human nature wants us to put everybody in a box and be able to quantify quantify everything and like check things and have numbers and, you know, where are you from? What do you do? You know,
right.
And that's a very complicated question. And it depends what day of the week you ask me.
Right. I was just going to get to that point. I mean, I think that's very astute. I'm sure, like, as anyone who's been walking their own lives for a long time, to be able to kind of like put themselves in a compartment is an interesting thing. But like, you are an engineer as well. So that's not disparate as I continue to think about it, because I think we all have facets. But how did you come to engineering and then become the presidential inaugural poet? We have about a minute left, and we'll get into that in the last segment. But I'd love to hear how that journey.
Yeah, very, very briefly. I mean, as a kid of working class immigrant family, I had very little access to arts and things like that. So, in some ways, it was just sort of that a practical sort of career choice. But I was great at math. I loved math. I was always a left brain, right brain person.
Mm-hmm.
I score exactly the same in all those standardized tests, in the verbal and the analytical. Mm-hmm. And so, I went on with my career as an engineer. And it was actually in engineering that I discovered writing. So there you go. half of my job in engineering was writing. Writing is so important to so many careers that people are not really come out of school not realizing that. And so writing reports, studies, letters, proposals, you get a $400 million job into your firm, it's based on a proposal, which is nothing but a narrative of your vision for the project and whatnot. So I really started getting into the intricacies of language and tone and diction and word choice and audience, and became the go-to person for writing. And then my right brain kicked on and said, hey, what else can we do with this language thing? And I thought, what's the weirdest thing I can do? I was like, let's write poetry. And so I just began it as, you know, I was like 25. I didn't start writing until I was 25 or 26. It's just sort of almost like a personal enrichment. Took a couple classes in the community college and eventually applied for a master's program, never thinking I was going to really be a published poet, but I was loving what I was doing. I was committed to it, but I didn't have any expectations. And somehow that seems to be a secret in life, but you can't fake it. You can't say you don't have any expectations if you really don't, if you really do. So really, it's interesting. Engineering paved the road to poetry. And I kind of profess that in my work. And also I speak to engineers. You know, knowledge to me is knowledge. It's all powerful. And in ways that all our identities add up to empower us, right?
Right.
I think, you know, everything that you learn in life is never going to go to waste. You'll always have a lead horse, but you always need the team of horses behind you, which are all the little things that you learn throughout your life.
Knowledge is knowledge. I think that's a great, great reminder for folks in the time of compartmentalization. I understand how that is. I remember being told that I had to specialize. I'm kind of we're around the same age, and I remember being kind of told that I needed to specialize, and that was the kind of the hardest thing for me to do. And this time, when you're starting to deal, you deal a lot with students. You're also an educator, and actually, you'll be in the Rogue Valley this summer. Working with the Southern Oregon University Young Artists Institute, how do you counsel students who may not have that reference?
Well, I always try to. Well, I should say that the theme of what we're doing with the young artists is boundaries, which is all sorts of boundaries, right? Kinds of what are the boundaries we put on ourselves? What are the boundaries that people put around us? And this will be my first time doing that program, so I'm super excited. It seems like it's just an amazing, amazing program.
Yeah.
How I counsel them is, you know, the story I just shared with you, and actually breaking it down to thinking about, you know, how I've seen knowledge come in and out of my life and how important it is. I always tell people, you know, in some ways, my math courses taught me as much about poetry as English class, because all the logic and the structure and the problem-solving skills of math, in a way, a poem is a emotional, geometric problem, right? And also vice versa. In my engineering, a couple of years writing poetry, and, you know, to be a poet is in part to be a study of human nature, right? Dealing with clients, which we know you might as well be a psychologist at that point, but not learning how to work with communities as a municipal civil engineer, I had to work with, you know, sit in a council meeting with, you know, 300 or 400 townspeople and shaping projects and listening and being able to just be a people person and realize that and just designing something wasn't good enough, that your design is only as good as it is useful to the user, and knowing that there is a user, right? In the same way that a poem has an audience, right? So all these things overlapped. As I always like to say, I think I tell, you know, the students, you know, I'm a better engineer because I'm a poet, and a better poet because I'm an engineer. And I try to get them to always realize to explore as much as they want. Yes, we have to pick a career. Yes, we have to have a major. We have to have this stuff. But again, you know, everything that you learn, whether it's out of a Wikipedia article or a minor that you do in school or something, that all of that in some ways feeds your passion and that great invention. I mean, great movements or great leaps in human history have always been about synthesis of knowledge, not reductionist theory, right?
Uh-huh.
Ironically, I think we're in a world where that's becoming more and more true, and yet our education system is starting to become more and more sliced even more and more thinly. I mean, I sometimes visit third or fourth or fifth grade, and they're already asking them, like, you know, what are you going to be and what kind of engineer? Like, and they're already sort of grooming them. I'm like, nobody says I want to be an astronaut anymore or a fireman. They're like, they're already pressured at that age, even at that age, to start thinking about, I'm only this, and you're going to spend the rest of your entire life. And I often tell the young students, too, like, you're going to probably live to be, like, 140. Do you know how many careers you're going to have from here to, like, I mean, we're living to 80 now. Like, so to just embrace it all and realize that what your major is not your life for right now. It's a starting point, and to continue to grow within your career, within the things that you love and your passions, as well as to grow personally. And you're making me think also that parallels this idea that we're also dealing with multiplicities of identity, right? Mm-hmm. We're all, some of my students at my alma mater, I teach once a year. I mean, I thought my life was complicated. Some of these kids, no, my grandmother's from China, my grandfather's Bolivian, my mother's Jamaican, and my dad's from Scotland. And you're like, what? Like, what did you just tell me? And, like, so, you know, it's becoming and yet we're supposed to be this one thing, right? And everybody just wants the one word answer, right? Or we're still in that world where we feel we need to have that one word identity.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point to offer to people in general, that the move through life is about synthesis, and that's the reason why you have two sides of your brain, because you use both of them, and right. A little bit, they'll be informed holistically. I should also say that the Young Artists Institute is a program of the pre-college programs here at Southern Oregon University in Ashland, Oregon, where students, as long as you're a high school student, from 14 to 17, there are program offerings that are exposure-based. So anyone in that age group, and I think, quite honestly, a broader, depending on the program, can come and get that kind of exposure that, you know, can be co-curricular or a part of just development as an individual. So they're open to anyone. They happen in the summer. And can be found on the Southern Oregon University website. Rachel Jones does a great job stewarding that process, and the staff there are continuing to make moves to get that info out and work out to the Rogue Valley and students in the Rogue Valley.
And it's also, and beyond. To our point, to our conversation, it's also interdisciplinary. So it's poetry, theater, visual arts, because those things have to communicate as well, so right. And can inspire and each other. So.
Yes, it's a beautiful thing. I think that's an interesting point, too, because you do a lot of work in terms of using verse as a community connector as well. How is verse and poetry a community connector?
You know, that's kind of, again, sort of this new, on my journey as a poet, and as started with the inauguration, which the inaugural poem was in a way my first spoken word poem, because it was a poem I wrote knowing it would be listened, that it would be heard before it would ever be read. And that got me to thinking about this, back to the oracular nature of poetry, where it began, of storytelling. If you really think about it, we've been sharing and thinking about poetry for many more hundreds of years before, you know, it was all oral tradition, it was all song, it was all community, it sprung from that need to connect, to sit or to be that proverbial village and sit around the proverbial campfire, because the printing press is just relatively in history, and books are relatively a new thing, right? And even in the last century, only the very rich way, but it's sort of just, you know, get books. And Shakespeare wasn't having book signings after the plays. And we kind of tend to forget that. So I started thinking about, you know, how that poem, the inaugural poem, did that. You know, it was that space, it created that space for poetry that was oracular. It was a very Whitman-esque moment, right? Where I mean, a poem read to 40 million people, a million people right in front of me, and 40 million. And it started me thinking, you know, how can poetry occupy public space? What is this role of the poet? What is the civic role of the poet? What is the civic role of poetry? What is the idea of socially conscious poetry? And that got me on this route of just using current events as a way to write, as a way to inspire poems. Also, I've been asked by several organizations to write poems, commission poems for, like, Freedom to Marry, which is a marriage equality organization, the Tech Awards in Silicon Valley, even some commercial projects for Bacardi and Havana Club, which had to deal with Cuban history. So it was really interesting. I'm really thrilled by it, by the idea of how poetry can reach out to people, because so many people are scared of poetry needlessly. You know, there are poets writing about the most accessible voices, connected to community, connected to the issues that affect us all on a large scale and on a small scale. And yes, there's still obscure poets and abstract poets, and there's a place for all of us, just like there's a place, there's all kinds of music and all kinds of novelists and all kinds of arts. You know, it's just a matter of finding the poetry or the poets that speak to you. But anyway, getting back to this idea, I'm really fascinated by that, because where we began this conversation, I had very limited access to poetry, when I never read a living poet till I was in my MFA program, and my Master in Fine in Creative Writing program, and that's sad. And I thought, I have to do something about. I mean, I want to do something about this. So I'm thinking about how poetry can come to you instead of you having to come to it, and then I've luckily have had the privilege to, because being an inaugural poet, it's such a public position, right? It's such a public, so much public exposure. I've done readings at the FDIC, at the USDA, at fundraisers, at all kinds of keynotes at churches, and I love how they're inviting poetry to create, to be at the center of a kind of a dialogue or of an experience, or to open up new questions or think about things in a different way. And it makes me very happy, because I often think, what if I would have had that experience maybe when I was 10, 12, 14, 18? Not that necessarily my life would be, you know, completely different, but I think I would have been a more aware and a more conscious and more happier person sooner, at least, you know, because the arts, and not just poetry, but the arts in general, let us, you know, think about that. And I really just want kids to have that exposure as early as possible. And that's part of what we're doing with the Young Artists Institute, which is what I love about their mission, you know, giving them that as early as possible.
And when will you be here?
So I got several events, which I have a little cheat sheet here, because there's several things. There's an adult writing workshop, which is co-presented by the Chautauqua Poets and Writers of Southern and Southern Oregon University. Now, I should say I've been to Ashland twice. I love the place. I've been with the Chautauqua Poets twice doing readings and workshops, and that will be on July 13th. And then we have a Think and Drink with Richard Blanco, which I just love that title.
Right.
I'm not sure at what point we're going to be doing more drinking than thinking, but I don't think they mean they drink like liquor here. It's kind of just a social thing, and it's also through Southern Oregon University and the Oregon Humanities Board, and that would be on Saturday the 13th. And then a poetry reading, which is also presented by Southern Oregon University on July 15th. So I imagine all this is in the days of Google. I'm sure this is all up on their website, so you can find it easily. But those are the three main events. Very excited to come back to Ashland and the larger community.
Mm-hmm. We have about a couple minutes left. I have a kind of a young, a very quick question on why do you think, from your point of view and voice, that you were chosen to be the presidential inaugural poet under Barack Obama's administration?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've had several opportunities and meetings with him after the inauguration. I never met him before the inauguration, which is interesting and really, I guess, was even more flattering, the fact that I didn't have a personal connection with him. So I've never quite dared ask him head on, you know, because in my head I still want to keep my romantic vision of him and Mrs. Obama in their bedroom in twin beds, because I always imagine them like Ricky and Ethel, Ricky and Lucy for some reason, and reading my poems and saying, oh, honey, we should get this poet in here. He's wonderful. But in conversations with him, and of course reading about, if you read his bio, you know, I think, I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but I think the connection point was, obviously, he's had these same questions, I think, about home and identity and place. I mean, he's written about them, right? Like, am I part of this American narrative? This, you know, he growing up in Hawaii is as isolating, I think, as it is growing up in Miami, because there are these cultural bubbles, in a way, that make you think about what the American narrative is. Also, with President Obama, the layer of race, which is another thing to contend with, another sense of identity to contend with, and thinking about, you know, does it mean to be American? What is the American dream? Am I part of that? Mm-hmm. So all these kinds of questions, I can imagine a little Ricky Obama, just like myself, asking those questions of, is this my country? You know, and then, of course, in his case, becoming the most American thing you could be, which is the president of the country. And ironically, that he also, by his selecting me, has made me realize all these things as well, and has made, in a way, my American dream come true.
Right on. Richard Blanco, thanks for coming here and talking to us. That's it for today's exchange, and you can learn more about the program and listen to the program or suggest a guest at our website, jeffexchange.org.